Chapter 8. Ethical Fading. It's hard to imagine that this actually happened. It is so far from ethical in any way. It's hard to imagine that a group of people who I'm sure consider themselves good and honest were able to behave in ways that, by any standard, are just plain wrong. From mid-2011 to about mid-2016, employees at Wells Fargo Bank opened over 3.5 million fake bank accounts. As the New York Times reported in 2016, some customers noticed the deception when they were charged unexpected fees, received credit or debit cards in the mail that they did not request, or started hearing from debt collectors about accounts they did not recognize. But most of the sham accounts went unnoticed, as employees would routinely close them shortly after opening them. Ultimately, 5,300 Wells Fargo employees were fired as a result of their involvement in these deceptive practices. Practices that then-CEO John Stumpf told Congress go against everything regarding our core principles, our ethics, and our culture. In a statement made to the press, the company echoed Stumpf, saying that the vast majority of our team members do the right thing every day on behalf of our customers, and if any of these things transpired, it's distressing and it's not who Wells Fargo is. In other words, Wells Fargo executives would like us to believe that the offenders were just a few bad apples. However, this was not an isolated act of a small group of people. This was the result of thousands of people acting over the course of years. The more likely scenario was that Wells Fargo's culture suffered from a severe case of ethical fading. Ethical fading is a condition in a culture that allows people to act in unethical ways in order to advance their own interests, often at the expense of others, while falsely believing that they have not compromised their own moral principles. Ethical fading often starts with small, seemingly innocuous transgressions that, when left unchecked, continue to grow and compound. While ethical lapses can happen anywhere, organizations run with a finite mindset are especially susceptible to ethical fading. As discussed in the previous chapters, cultures that place excessive focus on quarterly or annual financial performance can put intense pressure on people to cut corners, bend rules, and make other questionable decisions in order to hit the target set for them. Unfortunately, those who behaved dubiously but hit their targets are rewarded, which sends a clear message about the organization's priorities. Indeed, the reward systems in these organizations work to incentivize such behaviors. Those who meet their goals are given bonuses or promoted, often without consideration of the manner in which they met their goals, while those who acted with integrity but missed their targets are penalized by being overlooked for recognition or advancement. This sends a message to everyone else in the organization that making the numbers is more important than acting ethically. Those who may have been loath to follow the unethical example set by their colleagues succumb to the pressure as they start to feel it is the only way for them to get a bonus, get ahead, or even protect their job. They will lose perspective and rationalize their ethical transgressions. I gotta put food on the table. It's what management wants. I have no choice. And my personal favorite, it's the industry standard. Are all rationalizations we tell ourselves or tell others to help us mitigate any sense of guilt or responsibility we may feel? As human beings, we are blessed and cursed with our ability for rational thought. We try to make sense of the world around us. We can understand complex equations, and we have the ability to be introspective. It is with our capacity for rational and analytical thought that we can think through hard problems and advance technology. We can also use this capacity for analytical thinking to explain or justify our behavior when we know it violates some deep-seated code of ethics or helps us avoid some sense of guilt we may harbor for a decision or action we took. It's like stealing something from a rich friend and saying to yourself, they won't even notice. Besides, they can afford another one. We can rationalize it any way we want. We still stole something from a friend. When such rationalizations become commonplace inside an organization, The snowball grows and grows until unethical behavior pervades the entire organization and, in extreme cases, leads to the kind of corruption that happened at Wells Fargo. A culture of pressure, demands, and incentives. In 1973, two Princeton University psychology professors, John M. Darley and C. Daniel Batson, conducted an experiment to better understand how situational variables can affect our ethics, specifically, how pressure impacts our will to help someone in distress. They asked a group of seminary students to travel across campus to give a talk about the story of the Good Samaritan. The Good Samaritan is a parable from the New Testament, in which a Samaritan, traveling from Jericho to Jerusalem, is the only person to stop to help a man who had been beaten, robbed, and left on the side of the road. To recreate the scene, the professors hired an actor to lie in an alley, slumped over like he had been mugged or hurt in some way. The students would have to pass him as they made their way across campus. Each time the experiment was conducted with a different group of students, the professors added a little bit of pressure to see how it would affect the students' behavior. One group had a lot of pressure to hurry across campus. "You're late," the experimenters told them. "They were expecting you a few minutes ago. We'd better get moving. The assistant should be waiting for you, so you'd better hurry. It shouldn't take but just a minute." A second group had intermediate pressure put on them. "The assistant is ready for you, so please go right over." And the final group only had slight pressure added to them. "It'll be a few minutes before they're ready for you, but you might as well head on over. If you have to wait over there, it shouldn't be long." When there was low pressure, 63% of the students stopped to help the injured man. With medium pressure, 45% stopped to lend assistance. And under high pressure, only 10% of the students stopped to help someone in apparent distress. Some even stepped right over him. The conclusion was stark. The students were good people who cared about service. They were all studying to be priests, for heaven's sake. However, when pressure was placed upon them, in this case time pressure, their will to do the right thing gave way to demands placed upon them. And it was under extremely high pressure conditions that the people in the sales department at Wells Fargo were forced to operate. Though there were plenty of positive reinforcements offered to those who were able to make their numbers, regardless of how they made them, there was also a sense of fear instilled in those who didn't. Some employees recall being pushed to sell anywhere from 8 to 20 different products a day, and when they fell short of their goals, their managers berated them. One employee remembered her manager telling her, "If you don't meet your solutions, you're not a team player. If you're bringing down the team, then you will be fired, and it will be on your permanent record." The employee told her supervisors that she felt there was no ethical way she could meet their expectations and called the bank's ethics hotline multiple times to say as much. This is the kind of response we would hope for or expect from an employee when there is evidence of ethical lapses inside a large organization. But in the end, Wells Fargo decided to fire her rather than respond to her concerns. The expectation at Wells Fargo was that employees would never say when the quotas were impossible to meet. They were simply expected to find a way to meet them, whatever it took. As another Wells Fargo employee confessed, "It was the norm to just open sales unethically. It was what we were taught, and we just did it." Ethical fading is not an event. It doesn't just suddenly arrive like a switch was flipped. It's more like an infection that festers over time. Investigations into the scandal at Wells Fargo discovered an internal review from a decade before the scandal broke that revealed that the organization's toxic conditions and unethical behavior had already been identified. The original review concluded that there was an incentive to cheat based on fear of job loss. Though the results of the review were sent to the company's chief auditor, HR representatives, and others, the leadership did nothing to correct it. In addition, by 2010, a year before the fake account practices began, there were a reported 700 whistleblower complaints made about the questionable sales tactics at the company. The board of directors reported they knew nothing about them. John Stumpf became aware that his company had systemic problems as early as 2013. A 2017 board report revealed, however, that he knew of individual issues as far back as 2002, nearly 15 years before the scandal. The same 2017 report charged that Carrie Tolstead, former head of Wells Fargo Community Banks, not only knew about the wrongful sales practices, but actually reinforced the high-pressure sales culture. She was also, according to the report, notoriously resistant to outside intervention and oversight, and along with others in leadership, challenged and resisted scrutiny. One can only surmise that either she was subject to similar pressures and was afraid to speak out, or she was rewarded handsomely for the results her department achieved. Despite Wells Fargo's public statements that the scandal was confined to the retail sales group and that the majority of the company, quote, does the right thing, unquote, there was plenty of evidence that the ethical fading ran wide and deep throughout the company. Overlapping with the timing of the fake account scandal, for example, the bank was also misrepresenting the quality of loans they sold. In 2018, the bank was fined $2.09 billion to settle that issue. The auto division of the bank also agreed to repay $80 million back to customers for selling them auto insurance that they didn't sign up for. And the wholesale division, the group that Tim Sloan ran before he replaced John Stumpf to become CEO, fell under scrutiny for other ethical lapses that may have included money laundering. Wells Fargo did eventually accept accountability for opening up those millions of fake accounts and was fined a total of $185 million for doing so. The punishment they received, putting aside the temporary embarrassment and short-term impact on their stock price, however, was barely a slap on the wrist. To put things in perspective, $185 million represents less than 1% of Wells Fargo's total profit of $22 billion the year they were fined, and only 0.2% of their total revenues of nearly $95 billion. That's the equivalent of someone who makes $75,000 in annual salary being fined $150. Not much of a punishment. None of the company's leaders was held criminally liable for allowing a culture in which their own people committed fraud, which is a crime, to exist. No one went to jail. There wasn't even a single indictment. Indeed, John Stumpf did lose his job and $41 million of unvested equity, but he was only fired as a response to massive public pressure. What's more, he walked away with over $134 million in pension accounts and stock. So not only can leaders who oversee cultures in which ethical fading happens go unpunished, they can actually profit from it, which incentivizes leaders to maintain the status quo. I personally find it quite troubling when executives take credit for their culture of performance and yet take no responsibility for a culture consumed by ethical fading. When good people do bad things. As anyone who suffers from a life-threatening allergy to peanuts, bees, or shellfish well knows, a shot of epinephrine can save your life. And given its 90% market share, the odds are high that you'll get the shot from an EpiPen. The EpiPen is a brand of epinephrine auto-injector that stops anaphylactic shock. The product is essential for anyone with an extreme allergy. And because it has a 12-month lifespan, it has to be replaced on an annual basis. At a cost of $100 for a two-pack, that makes for a good business. In 2007, a company called Mylan bought the rights to the EpiPen brand. Given the dominance the brand had on the market, combined with the fact that there was no generic option at the time, there was nothing to stop Mylan from raising the price of the product by an average of 22% per year. Seeing the impact these price increases had on their stock value, in 2014, the board decided to up the ante. They offered select employees a one-time opportunity. If they doubled the company's earnings per share over the next 5 years, they would share in what could be hundreds of millions of dollars in bonuses. The top five executives alone would stand to make nearly $100 million. No doubt responding to this incentive, in the following year, the company sped up the rate of EpiPen price increases from 22% to 32%. After the 15th price hike since 2009, in 2016, Mylan announced that a pair of EpiPens would now cost an all-time high of $600, representing a 500% increase over just 6 years. The company probably would have continued to raise the price had it not been for a massive public outcry and congressional inquiry by the House Oversight Committee. When asked later if she was sorry for what happened, CEO Heather Bresch replied, "I wasn't going to be apologetic for operating in the system that existed. As an aside, accountability is when we take responsibility for our own actions, not when we blame our actions on the system." The ethical fading was so complete at Mylan that Bresch didn't seem to perceive that she or her company had done anything wrong. Indeed, Bresch mind-bogglingly argued that the EpiPen scandal was a good thing because it brought attention to abuses in the healthcare system and served as a catalyst for change. Of course, if Mylan had a culture that placed ethics above earnings and believed its primary responsibility was to its just cause rather than itself or its shareholders, then the company could have used their might in the market to become a champion for change much sooner and with a lot less fuss. Acting unethically, getting caught with your hand in the cookie jar, refusing to accept responsibility for your behavior, and then pointing to systemic abuses that made you do those things does not make you Joan of Arc. Incidentally, 2 years after the EpiPen pricing scandal, Mylan settled with the U.S. Justice Department for $465 million for overcharging the government for EpiPens it misclassified as generic rather than branded. As acting U.S. Attorney William D. Weinrep explained, Mylan misclassified its brand name drug, EpiPen, to profit at the expense of the Medicaid program. Taxpayers rightly expect companies like Mylan that receive payments from taxpayer-funded programs to scrupulously follow the rules. Perhaps Mylan suffers from a severe allergy to acting ethically. But it can't just be a flawed incentive structure that drives good people to do bad things. If that's all it was, we would expect the people who engage in such behaviors to be consumed by guilt and struggle to sleep at night. By all evidence, though, they seem completely relaxed about the choices they make, and in Bresch's case, defensive and unapologetic. According to social scientists who study the phenomenon of ethical fading, those who commit such violations of trust aren't evil, but they do suffer from self-deception. Self-deception. We humans have all sorts of clever ways to rationalize our behavior and deceive ourselves into thinking that the ethically questionable decisions we make are fair and justified, even though a reasonable person would view our actions as quite the opposite. Anne Tenbrunsel, professor of business ethics at the University of Notre Dame, and David Messick, professor emeritus of the Management and Organizations Department at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management, are among those who have studied self-deception as a mechanism of ethical fading in organizations. In their work, they identify several uncomfortably simple and common ways that we, as individuals and groups, are able to engage in unethical behavior without perceiving it as unethical. One of the ways we are able to deceive ourselves comes from the words we use, the use of euphemisms, to be exact. Euphemisms allow us to disassociate ourselves from the impact of the decisions or actions we might otherwise find distasteful or hard to live with. Politicians were aware that Americans find torture to be inhumane and inconsistent with our values, so enhanced interrogation became the way for them to protect our homeland after September 11 without feeling bad about it. We do the same thing in business. It is common practice in the working world to choose language that softens or obscures the impact of our behavior. We talk about managing externalities instead of talking plainly about the harm our manufacturing practices cause to the people who work in our factories and to the environment. Gamification to enhance the user experience is easier to swallow than we found a way to get people addicted to our product to boost our results. Human beings become data points, and data mining is a more palpable way of saying that we are tracking people's every click, trip, and personal habit. We reduce headcounts, and the online ticket broker charges us a convenience fee instead of calling it what it is, a surcharge. The words we choose can help us distance ourselves from any sense of responsibility. They can, however, help us act more ethically, too. Imagine if we actually started calling things what they are within our organizations. If we did, perhaps we would take the time to find more creative and, indeed, more ethical ways of achieving our goals. And in so doing, actually strengthen our cultures in the process. But more on that later. Another kind of self-deception that contributes to ethical fading is when we remove ourselves from the chain of causation, or, as the CEO of Mylan did, blame the system for our own transgressions. Sometimes we can take ourselves so far out of the chain of causation that we actually lay all the responsibility for how our products affect a consumer on the consumer. Though it's a legitimate legal concept, caveat emptor, or buyer beware, is often cited by companies to disassociate themselves from the impact of their decisions. If they don't like it, the thinking goes, then they don't have to buy it. This is the oft-invoked response we hear from executives when questioned about their responsibility for the negative effects of their products. Though consumer choice is absolutely a factor, this cannot and does not completely remove an organization from the chain of causation. Yes, the smoker is responsible for the damage they do to their health from smoking, but the cigarette companies are still involved in the chain. Fulfilling one's legal responsibility does not release a company from their ethical responsibility either. After we click a box to accept their terms and conditions, for example, many companies believe that they are free of responsibility for what happens next. Legally, that may be true, but ethically speaking, they are not. Instagram, Snapchat, Facebook, and any number of mobile gaming companies, for example, cannot deny their role in making what is increasingly accepted as addictive technology simply because there is not yet a law against it, particularly when they knowingly add features such as infinite scroll, like buttons, and automatic content play with the intent of keeping us peeled for longer. These companies almost always explain that they add such features or need to collect our personal data in order to enhance the user experience. Though we may indeed receive some benefit from these decisions, there is also a cost. Weighing those benefits against the harm they may cause or whether they violate our values is what ethics is all about. Nothing is for free. In a 2019 opinion piece in the Washington Post, Mark Zuckerberg, the founder and CEO of Facebook, responded to some of the criticism against his company by asking government for more legislation. "I believe we need a more active role for governments and regulators," he wrote. "By updating the rules for the internet, we can preserve what's best about it." It's as if he's saying that because of Milton Friedman's definition of the responsibility of business, Facebook can only be ethical if the laws and ethical custom require them to be. It's sad that we have reached a point in some industries, like technology and social media, where we probably do have to legislate ethics. But how did we arrive here in the first place? Ten Brunsel and Messick identify the proverbial slippery slope as another enabler of the kind of self-deception that leads to ethical fading. With each ethical transgression that is tolerated, we pave the road for more and bigger ethical transgressions. Little by little, we change the norms inside a culture of what is acceptable behavior. If everyone else is doing it, it must be okay. When leaders maintain an excessive focus on the finite game, these slippery slopes are often missed or willfully ignored because they're so profitable. In an organization that has adopted an infinite mindset, an unethical idea designed to grow the bottom line is always a bad idea that we wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole. In an organization obsessed with the finite game and suffering from fading ethics, that same idea is fantastic. I can't believe we didn't think of it sooner. Add an unbalanced reward structure that focuses on performance and ignores trust, and the ethical lapses start to move as if they were sliding down a slip and slide, coated in Teflon, covered in baby oil, until they reach full-blown ethical fading at the end. Like the slow boiling of the proverbial frog, Mylan's incremental increase of EpiPen prices was no doubt intended to lessen the shock, or increase the acceptance, of a huge sudden price increase on consumers. However, it also reveals ethical fading at work. By increasing the price over time, even over a short time, they saw their metrics soar. As the numbers went up, many probably started to imagine what they would spend their bonuses on. Focused on the massive upside they would personally gain, Mylan's executives were able to get ethically comfortable with their decisions, and so they increased the rate of the price increases to hit or beat their goals even quicker. It's as if they were acting like addicts who couldn't wait patiently to get their next fix. Mylan and Wells Fargo are extreme examples of ethical fading, and such extreme examples are helpful for us to see the mechanics of ethical fading at work. But don't be fooled, and don't get comfortable. Just because there is no fraud or scandal doesn't mean we don't have a problem. In fact, if we look closely, we begin to see signs of ethical fading in a lot of businesses. Tricks of accounting to reduce a company's tax burden, for example, or offering a rebate on a product and then purposely making customers perform so many steps, cut out the barcode from the box, fill out the form, attach the receipt, mail it in, that the majority of people, as the company knows full well, won't bother doing it, is another. Or food and beverage companies exaggerating the health benefits of a product, attempting to hide some of the unhealthy ingredients, or tinkering with the portion size on a package to make it look like their product has less sugar or fewer calories than it actually does. None of it is illegal. All of it is a little uncomfortable. And the more we all allow such decisions to be made, the more such behavior becomes normal or the industry standard. Remember, ethical fading is about self-delusion. Anyone, regardless of their personal moral compass, can succumb to it. The leaders we point out and vilify for running their businesses unethically, and then accepting a handsome reward for doing so, don't think they've done anything wrong. And if you don't think you're doing anything wrong, what incentive do you have to do things differently? In a case like Mylan or Wells Fargo, it took a public scandal to expose the problem. But a spotlight doesn't fix the problem. In most of our organizations, there won't be a crisis like those to help see some of the ugly truths. And as long as ethical fading goes unchecked, the odds are high that, eventually, something is going to break. And the cost, not only to our companies, but also to our people, our customers, and our investors, will be far greater than any cost we would bear to fix things now. On taking over as CEO at Wells Fargo, Tim Sloan admitted that management, quote, recognized too late the full scope and seriousness of the problems, unquote, and vowed that such a situation, quote, will never be allowed to occur again, unquote. Such promises are easily made, not so easily kept. Ethical fading can be extremely difficult to reverse, almost impossible if the leaders trying to change the culture remain finite-minded in their approaches. Because what do finite-minded leaders do when they set out to change a culture that suffers ethical fading? You guessed it, they apply a finite solution. Hint, it doesn't work. When structure replaces leadership. I used to work for a large advertising agency. After my first year at the company, leadership decided to implement timesheets. Unlike a law firm, where a lawyer may be billing their clients for the actual number of hours of work, this was a way for the company to keep track of. Actually, no one really had any idea of the utility of the timesheets. It was just something we were told to do. I managed to get away with not filling out mine for months. If they were tracking how I spent my time, I saw no point in telling the company I worked 100% on the one client to which I was assigned. Of course, I got in trouble for not turning in my timesheets. And so, from then on, at the end of every month, I sat down with all my timesheets and filled them out in one go, in at 9:30 a.m., out at 5:30 p.m. In reality, I often came in earlier and left later, but who cares? I recall taking my timesheets to my boss for his signature. He looked them over and commented sarcastically, "You certainly are a very consistent worker, aren't you?" And then he signed them. I have to believe that the timesheets were implemented because something went wrong in accounting. Perhaps a client was overbilled for work done and demanded that the agency prove that the senior people who were promised to spend time on their account actually were the ones who spent time on the account, or something like that. In order to correct the issue in accounting, a new process was implemented across the company. This kind of solution is what Dr. Leonard Wong calls lazy leadership. When problems arise, performance lags, mistakes are made, or unethical decisions are uncovered, lazy leadership chooses to put their efforts into building processes to fix the problems rather than building support for their people. After all, process is objective and reliable. It's easier to trust a process than to trust people. Or so we think. In reality, process will always tell us what we want to hear, Dr. Wong points out. Process gives us a green light, he continues, but it may not be telling us the truth. When leaders use process to replace judgment, the conditions for ethical fading persist, even in cultures that hold themselves to higher moral and ethical standards. Soldiers, for example, believe that they hold themselves to a higher standard of honesty and integrity than the general public, and the general public thinks so too. However, in their paper, Lying to Ourselves, Dishonesty in the Army Profession, Dr. Wong and his research partner, Dr. Stephen Garris, both retired Army officers who now work at U.S. Army War College, discovered systemic ethical fading as a result of excessive process, procedure, or demands placed on soldiers. Some of the things leadership was asking of their soldiers weren't unreasonable, they were impossible. Soldiers were required, for example, to complete more days of training than were available in the calendar. As in the corporate world, pressure to complete tasks comes from the top down in the Army. However, there is also a huge amount of pressure that comes from the bottom up. In an effort to stand out, officers want to appear as if they can do everything and do everything well. A failure to complete requirements could sully a commander's image, earn reprimands, and affect promotions. Submitting a false report of compliance helps keep the system running smoothly and keeps their careers on track. And because the punishment for being honest is sometimes greater than for lying, soldiers are put in a position where they feel they have to lie or cheat in order to meet the requirements placed upon them. It's a catch-22. The result is that it has become commonplace for soldiers to find creative ways to complete their requirements while feeling that their high moral standards remain uncompromised. One example Wong and Garris give involves the last-minute training requirements that units had to complete before deploying to Afghanistan or Iraq. Soldiers had to insert their ID cards into a computer to authenticate their identity in order to complete the computer-based training. One officer admitted that he would collect all the IDs of his 9-man squad, then pick the smartest guy in the group to complete the training 9 times so that everyone could get a certificate. Rather than seeing their actions as cheating or lying, many soldiers saw it simply as checking the boxes, part of the bureaucratic process, or just doing what leadership wanted them to do. Some didn't see their actions as unethical at all because they viewed the demands as so trivial that they existed outside of any standard of integrity or honesty, like me and my timesheets. It's like telling someone we have to cancel plans because of a family issue when in reality there is no family issue. We just want to get out of the plans without hurting someone's feelings. And though we told a lie, because it's just a little harmless white lie, we still believe ourselves to be honest. When these seemingly minor transgressions become pervasive in a culture, however, it is a sign of ethical fading. Remember, the very definition of ethical fading is engaging in unethical behavior while believing that we are still acting in line with our own moral or ethical code. As in the corporate world, if any of the unethical acts that the soldiers committed were to lead to more severe consequences that would cause public outrage, it is likely that the soldiers would indeed be punished, and the rest of the Army subjected to additional online training to prevent anything like that from ever happening again, of course. There is a great irony in all this. When we apply finite-minded solutions to address an ethical fading problem that finite-minded thinking created, we get more ethical fading. When we use process and structure to fix cultural problems, what we often get is more lying and cheating. Little lies become bigger lies, and the behavior becomes normalized. Lazy leadership is not a euphemism for bad leaders or bad people. Just like a person who chooses not to exercise is not a bad person, decisions made by lazy leadership can often be very well intended. In the case of the army, or any large organization for that matter, leadership may genuinely believe all the extra demands and requirements they place on soldiers are helpful. But because senior leaders are rarely subjected to those extra demands themselves, they may be oblivious to the problems that their solutions cause. However, if they were aware of, or also subjected to the hypocrisy, dysfunction, or excessive bureaucracy, then, like my boss at the agency, they too could become complicit in the charade. When that happens, those leaders are likely also engaging in rationalization and self-deception, and the slope grows slipperier. If ethical fading can happen in places where integrity is taken really seriously, like the military, then it can happen anywhere. And it does. I cannot stress enough how common ethical fading is in our companies and institutions. However, more structure is not the antidote to ethical fading. Process is great for managing a supply chain. Procedure helps improve manufacturing efficiencies. Ethical fading, however, is a people problem. And counterintuitive though it may seem, we need people, not paperwork, not training, not certifications, to fix people problems. The best antidote and inoculation against ethical fading is an infinite mindset. Leaders who give their people a just cause to advance and give them an opportunity to work with a trusting team to advance it will build a culture in which their people can work toward the short-term goals while also considering the morality, ethics, and wider impact of the decisions they make to meet those goals. Not because they are told to, not because there's a checklist that requires it, and not because they took the company's online course on acting ethically. They did so because it's the natural thing to do. We act ethically because we don't want to do anything that would do damage to the advancement of the just cause. When we feel part of a trusting team, we don't want to let down our teammates. We feel accountable to our team and the reputation of the organization, not just to ourselves and personal ambitions. When we feel part of a group that cares about us, we want to do right by that group and make our leaders proud. Our standards naturally rise. As social animals, we respond to the environments we're in. Put a good person in an environment that suffers ethical fading, and that person becomes susceptible to ethical lapses themselves. Likewise, take a person, even one who may have acted unethically in the past, put them in a stronger, more values-based culture, and that same person will also act in accordance with the standards and norms of that environment. As I've said before, leaders are not, by definition, responsible for the results. Leaders are responsible for the people who are responsible for the results. It's a job that requires constant attention because when little things compound, things eventually break. Infinite-minded leaders accept that creating a culture that is more resistant to ethical fading requires patience and hard work. It requires devotion to a cause, a bias for will before resources, and the ability to nurture trusting teams. It may take longer than a quarter or a year, depending on the size of the company, to feel the impact of the investment. And once the ethical standards are established or re-established, they must be guarded vigilantly. If ethical fading is powered by self-deception, maintaining ethical behavior demands complete honesty and constant self-assessment. Ethical lapses happen and are part of being human. Ethical fading, however, is not part of being human. Ethical fading is a failure of leadership and is a controllable element in a corporate culture, which means the opposite is also true. Cultures that are ethically strong are also a result of the culture the leaders build. When acting ethically is the standard. On November 25, 2011, outdoor clothing company Patagonia took out a full-page ad in the New York Times with the headline, "Don't buy this jacket." Though some cynics saw the headline as a publicity stunt by a high-priced brand that many people can't afford, it is in the details of the ad that we can find clues about the kind of culture Patagonia has and that inspired such an ad in the first place. In the body copy of the ad, Patagonia did something most other companies would consider unthinkable. They explained in plain language the environmental cost of making their product, in this case, the best-selling R2 fleece. The copy read, "To make this jacket required 135 liters of water, enough to meet the daily needs, 3 glasses a day, of 45 people. Its journey from its origin as 60% recycled polyester to our Reno warehouse generated nearly 20 pounds of carbon dioxide, 24 times the weight of the finished product. This jacket left behind on its way to Reno 2/3 its weight in waste. There is much to be done and plenty for us all to do," the ad concludes. "Don't buy what you don't need. Think twice before you buy anything. Join us to reimagine a world where we take only what nature can replace." "We did it out of guilt," says Patagonia founder Yvon Chouinard. "We all know we have to consume less." While other companies might use euphemisms to distance themselves from or cloud the impact of their actions, Patagonia takes full ownership of its role in the chain of causation and offers no exceptions or excuses that might lead the way down a slippery slope. They are brutally honest with themselves and the public about how their actions impact the world, for better or for worse. They know that if they want to survive and thrive in the infinite game, they have to be this honest. They don't portray themselves as victims of the system, but rather a part of it, and they are doing what they can to change it. It's hard to even imagine Mylan taking an ad out of the New York Times, explaining that they knew they were taking advantage of people with life-threatening allergies by raising the price of EpiPens by 500%, claiming that they did so to highlight the unethical and legal abuses in the pharmaceutical industry. The post-mortem after any scandal or case of ethical fading nearly always reveals a failure of leadership. Companies with cultures like Mylan and Wells Fargo are almost destined to suffer some sort of ethical fading. With the words of Milton Friedman by their side, their leaders think they are there to drive results, and their incentive structures reinforce that belief. As a result, they prioritize near-term financial results above any sense of cause, if they even have one. Operating with a bias toward resources before will, the leaders willingly adjust their cultures to meet their priorities. At Patagonia, like any other infinite-minded organization, they turn to their just cause to help set their priorities, and the behavior follows accordingly. It's not just about how much money they can make this year. Quote, "We plan to be here in the next 100 years, so we think about long-term results," says Dean Carter, Vice President of Human Resources and Shared Services at the company. Operating with an infinite mindset, Patagonia's intention is not to win or beat anyone else in their market. Rather, Patagonia is driven by a vision of the future in which they make high-quality products while causing the least harm and use business to inspire and implement solutions to the environmental crisis. Patagonia is by no means a perfect company. They make mistakes, and individuals within the company still suffer ethical lapses. Patagonia recognizes this and understands that its pursuit of the just cause is a journey of constant self-improvement. At too many companies, the term constant improvement often means improving process and enhancing efficiency. At Patagonia and other infinite-minded companies, where the currencies of will and resources are both on the radar, constant improvement refers to every facet of their organization, including their culture and the standards by which their culture operates. This is what helps them maintain a culture of high ethical standards. Patagonia is not driven to be the best. They are driven to be better. Even if the headline fell flat to some, the "Don't Buy This" campaign was not a one-off gimmick. It was typical of Patagonia's relentless effort to hold themselves accountable and constantly improve. As their website says, Patagonia is a growing business, and we want to be in business a good long time. The test of our sincerity, or our hypocrisy, will be if everything we sell is useful, multifunctional where possible, long-lasting, beautiful but not enthralled to fashion. We're not yet entirely there. The copy goes on to admit that not all the company's products meet these criteria, but then go on to introduce their Common Threads initiative, a program they hope will help advance them towards their goals. Their initiative includes a commitment to make high-quality clothes that will last a long time, so they don't have to be routinely replaced, which reduces waste. A promise to repair their products for free so that people don't throw them out, which reduces waste. A partnership with eBay so that people can reuse, buy and sell secondhand products, which reduces waste. And when a product finally does come to the end of its life, Patagonia will take it off your hands to recycle it rather than have us throw it in the garbage, which reduces waste. While some companies go out of their way to find loopholes they can exploit to enhance their performance, Patagonia goes out of its way to close loopholes that enhance their values and beliefs. For the past decade, for example, the company has been working with the NGO Verité to uncover and correct labor abuses within its first-tier supply chain, in the factories that produce their goods. As a result of separate internal audits in 2011, the company found that despite their efforts to create a socially responsible supply chain, there was still a number of violations, including multiple cases of human trafficking and exploitation at the second-tier level, the factories that turn raw materials into fabrics and other parts needed for production. It is remarkable that Patagonia was even looking at, let alone trying to improve, conditions in its second-tier suppliers. Even the Fair Labor Association, which conducts spot audits of factories abroad and helps companies improve their corporate responsibility programs, wrote Gillian White for an article in The Atlantic, only requires that affiliated brands audit, monitor, and report on their first-tier suppliers, a level at which issues of human trafficking are easier to spot and respond to. Rooting out forced labor is a difficult and complex undertaking that requires a major commitment of time and investment of resources. Most companies wait to tackle it only when they're forced to, either out of embarrassment or legal trouble. Patagonia, of its own accord, has made the commitment and the investment, knowing that it may never completely solve the problem. But they will damn well keep trying, which is the whole point of constant improvement and ethical action. Indeed, it is the very standard of an effective just cause, that we may never reach the ideal we imagine, but we will die trying. This gives purpose and meaning to the work we do at the companies we work for and inspires us to keep fighting the good fight. Finite-minded companies might worry that this kind of approach may cost too much, hurt profits, lose customers, or ruin their reputation. Few companies want to proactively admit that they do anything wrong these days. Patagonia is not worried about those things, and they are not afraid to get out ahead of the crowd and take big risks. Of course, the company has a huge advantage that it freely admits. It's a private company. The pressure of a public company to drive profit on a quarterly basis for people who only have a financial vested interest in the outcome of the company is significant, Dean Carter reminds us. So it does help to be private when our vested interest is certainly to make a bigger impact. Though Patagonia is a certified B Corp, a company that practices stakeholder capitalism, it is not a charity. It is a for-profit organization that wants to make more money this year than they made last year. However, they also recognize that making money is not the reason they exist. Like all good, infinite-minded companies, they see money as the fuel they need to continue to pursue their just cause. To certify as a B Corp, companies are required to identify their most deeply held social and environmental values, then abide by them, honoring their responsibilities to their employees, customers, suppliers, and communities, as well as to the financial health of their investors. Patagonia knows that the more successful their business, the more they can uphold that standard and the greater the positive impact they can have in the world. They know that in the long term, if they keep their eye on the just cause and continue to guard against ethical fading, they will attract and lead those who share their vision and values, and they will thrive as a result. Ethical decisions are not based on what's best for the short term. They are based on the right thing to do. Whereas short-termism at the expense of ethics slowly weakens a company, doing the right thing slowly strengthens it. Patagonia's pattern of trying its hardest to do the right thing and put people and planet before profits has earned the company fierce loyalty from employees and customers alike. This, combined with the goodwill and trust they have built in the market, has helped them become one of the most successful, innovative, and profitable companies in their category. The company has experienced a quadrupling of revenue over the past decade, with profits tripling. In the words of Patagonia's CEO, Rose Marcario, "Doing good work for the planet creates new markets and makes us more money." Notice the order in which she presents her priorities. "As far out on the horizon line as we can see right now," says Rick Ridgway, Patagonia's VP of Environmental Affairs, "we're continuing to produce products that allow people to live a more responsible life with the apparel that they choose. As long as there's a lot of other people out there that don't do that, then we should be growing." Still, Ridgway acknowledges, quote, "there is a point out there where our own growth is going to likely create more problems than it does solutions," unquote. It remains to be seen how Patagonia will deal with that point if and when they arrive at it. But the very fact that they are thinking about it, and talking about it, publicly no less, is yet another sign of their ethical strength. As a result of leading with an infinite mindset, Patagonia has not only created a company more resistant to ethical fading, but has also set the bar for what acting ethically can look like in business. And that's by design. "If we can show the business community that we're successful," says COO Doug Freeman, "we think we're holding ourselves as a great example of how business can be done differently." Patagonia acts in a way that is not just good for them, it's good for the game. And it's working. Other companies now follow their lead.